From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Pakistanis vote tomorrow in a long-awaited parliamentary election. Opposition parties fear the government will try to rig the vote, since opinion polls indicate the party supporting President Pervez Musharraf is trailing. A wave of violence has marred the election campaign. The assassination of opposition leader Benazir Bhutto in December, and just yesterday, another suicide bombing that killed dozens of her supporters in a tribal area. Tomorrow's parliamentary vote is supposed to mark the final step in Pakistan's transition from military to civilian rule. But Pakistan's army has ruled the country for half of its 60-year history. And as NPR's Jackie Northam reports, few Pakistanis believe the military can keep away from politics.
In late November, when President Pervez Musharraf resigned as military chief, it was supposed to mark a new era for Pakistan. Musharraf was just the latest in a long line of military dictators. He ruled for 8 years. By the time Musharraf relinquished his post, there was deep, widespread anger towards him. And that anger extended to the military, according to Rodad Khan, a former top bureaucrat who has worked under six Pakistani leaders. Khan says people in Pakistan are fed up with military rule.
There is one core issue before the people of Pakistan today, you know. And that core issue is how to get rid of army rule, you know. Because unless you do that, Pakistan is not going to progress.
Khan says because Pakistan's political process has been interrupted so many times, a stable democracy has been unable to evolve. Khan says as a result, the military is pervasive in the country's politics.
Even when they are not directly in power, they control the politics of Pakistan, and some of the crucial decisions, crucial issues, are really determined by the army.
Crucial issues like foreign policy. Pakistan's relationships with India, Afghanistan, and the U.S. are determined by the military. And the decision to become a nuclear-armed state was made by Pakistan's army. Professor Pervez Hoodboy, a security analyst, says even the economy is controlled by the army.
The Pakistani military makes everything from sugar and cement down to cornflakes and bottled water. So as a consequence of this, the economy has also been subverted, and so the normal competition that you would expect in an economy is simply not there because the army has so big a share of the pie.
Many people feel the army may be moving away from this dominance under General Ashfaq Kiani, the man who replaced Musharraf as Army Chief of Staff, the most powerful position in the country. Over the past month, Kiani has made some key and bold steps. First, he declared that no military officials could have any dealing with a politician unless it is cleared through him first, and that includes President Musharraf. Then Kiani called back scores of military officers from plum civilian positions that were handed out as perks by Musharraf, powerful positions in ministries such as transportation, communication, and the Water and Power Authority. Nazim Zera, a security analyst, says General Kiani appears aware that he needs to roll back some of the military's power.
I think it's, mother necessity in this case is because it's a question of the institution's reputation, institution's well-being, and the country's well-being at stake.
But Kiani must move slowly in order to prevent any backlash. Many generals have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. Professor Hoodboy thinks Kiani may make some positive changes in the short term, but he says the army has no intention of going back to the barracks permanently.
The army just wants to be away from the public eye at the moment because he's being held responsible for all the ills of the country today. But they have no intention of surrendering power. They don't believe that the people of Pakistan are capable of running the country. They think that they are the rightful owners of this country. And that kind of attitude will take a long time to change.
Tomorrow's elections may bring a new civilian government into power in Pakistan, but there's little doubt that the country's army will still be hovering on the horizon. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Islamabad.
And NPR's Jackie Northam joins me on the line now. Jackie, the election is just hours away. There's been a spate of violence, a terrible bombing yesterday. What's the mood in Pakistan now?
I think there's a collective sense of apprehension over how this election will go. Certainly many people are expecting violence, and the government has called out over 100,000 troops and police and paramilitary to try to keep the peace. But there are many regions in this country that are dangerous, certainly the port city of Karachi, and all throughout the tribal region as well. As you say, there was a large bombing yesterday in the northwest of the country that left at least 40 people dead. That number is expected to rise. But there have been many other small bombings that are targeting campaign headquarters or political workers, and about 25 political workers have been killed this week alone. So many people are expecting that we'll see more of that tomorrow. On the other hand, the elections could be relatively quiet. It's expected to be a low turnout, either because of the security reasons or just plain apathy. And instead of widespread violence, you could just see a lot of backroom negotiations going on between the various parties to come up with a new government.
NPR's Jackie Northam in Islamabad. Jackie, thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. As President Bush continued his African tour today, he won praise from Tanzania's president for U.S. help in fighting HIV/AIDS and malaria. Among the U.S. projects in Africa are malaria vaccine studies conducted by the National Institutes of Health involving the Malinke people of Mali. Reporter Addie Goss recently visited an NIH-funded facility in the village of Bankmana.
Bankmana wakes up to the sound of women pounding millet outside their mud huts. During the rainy season here, the rice fields are flooded, mosquitoes are born, and malaria is like the flu. Everybody gets it. Modibo Jabate is a griot, a kind of village journalist. In Bankmana, he says, there's a severe form of malaria that kills the children. The Malinke call it konon, which means bird.
L'enfant convulse, ouvre les yeux.
The child convulses. He opens his eyes wide and screeches. It's like a bird has seized him.
There's a small health clinic here, but it can take people days to gather the few dollars for prescriptions. So until recently, most parents brought their sick children to the village healer, who gives them traditional medicine. They'd pay him in kola nuts.
Les gens sont là à la merci de...
People were at the mercy of the mosquitoes. Many children never reached 10 years.
Then, about 15 years ago, a Malian doctor came to Bankmana to study which strains of malaria were making kids sick. His name is Ogobara Dumbo, or Ogo, and the griot Jabate remembers that from the start, Ogo saved lives.
Donc on vient dans la famille. Hey, madame.
He went to families and he asked, Madame, what brings malaria? There were some who said it was cold water, some who said it was the mangoes, and Ogo said no. It's mosquitoes. You have to protect yourself. Clean your yard. Sleep under a mosquito net. Don't let containers of water sit around.
A few years ago, the Malian Dr. Ogo got a grant from the U.S. National Institutes of Health to start testing a malaria vaccine in 300 children here. Over time, that grant helped build a medical research center in the middle of Bankmana. They built it side by side with the local clinic, which didn't even have water or electricity. Ogo says parents signed their kids up for the vaccine trials partly as a matter of village pride.
They think they have opportunity to participate in an international challenge of developing a vaccine to save the life of thousands and millions of kids. Really, the first volunteer I have had, they say, if you get a vaccine, they will say Bankmana was the first village. That makes them very proud, I can tell you.
There would be two groups of children. One would get a shot containing the experimental malaria vaccine. The other would get a shot of the control, a flu vaccine that had already been shown to be safe. The experimental vaccine had been tested for safety in adults in Mali and in the United States with no significant problems. But the only children who would receive the vaccine were 36 kids in another village. This raises questions for ethicists like Lawrence Gostin at Georgetown Law School. He says ideally you don't want to give vulnerable people like the Malinke anything that hasn't first been proven safe in children in the developed world.
Questions of, is there an undue incentive? Do the parents really understand? Is there the same culture? all loom very large.
But the NIH-funded researchers say they're doing everything they can to avoid exploiting the villagers. Most parents in Bankmana are illiterate, so the researchers read them an explanation of what the vaccine is and what the risks are. And they take pains to make sure parents understand what they've been read. Gostin says the bottom line is a malaria vaccine could save countless lives. And as they test it, NIH is providing desperately poor Malians with health care they wouldn't otherwise have.
There are some ethicists that think that if you have a trial in a developing country, that you use exactly the same standards as you do in the United States. I don't believe that that's true, because I think that if you take that standard, you end up not doing any service to people that are suffering desperately.
The researchers treat any child enrolled in the study for any illness. Parents here say they've enrolled their children for just that reason, because they can't afford to go to the village clinic. Then, to make sure they're not coercing people, the researchers also provide some health services to villagers who are not participating in the vaccine trials. Like this little boy. His dad took him to the village clinic today, and the doctor wanted to do some blood tests for liver failure, but the clinic doesn't have anything even close to a lab. So the doctor called the NIH-funded researchers, and now the boy is at the research center, having blood drawn for tests. The researchers do this for free. Even the traditional healer, Nyangana Fode, says he's thrilled the researchers have taken his patients away.
Before they came, I never slept because everyone brought their sick babies to me. Now, when a child comes here with a fever, I send him to the researchers.
The healer says this while sitting in bed in his hut. Over his head is a mosquito net the doctors gave him. Another day ends in Bankmana. Men and women walk back from the fields, and their children gather at the research center, one of the few places in town with electricity, to watch TV. For NPR News, I'm Addie Goss.
We know it's primary season, but that may be the only season that's clear. In Los Angeles, there was rain and 40-degree temperatures not long ago. Sarasota swimmers got goosebumps climbing out of heated pools. And here in the nation's capital, it was almost 70 degrees on a recent day before the temperature plunged back down to the 20s. These big chills made NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg decide it was time to knit.
Airport security confiscated my tube of toothpaste last week, but for some reason didn't mind the lethal-looking size 11 needles I'm using to knit. Not a sweater or scarf, although warm would certainly be welcome right now, but no, I'm knitting my very first baby blanket for my very first grandchild, granddaughter. Avidly expected in the middle of April. It's the first knitting I've done in decades, and it brings back so many memories. Here at NPR, hosting All Things Considered in the 1970s, I knitted my way through various 70s upheavals, including the Watergate hearings, of course. Nixon, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Sirica, and Irvin became part of the stitchery. Knit 1, Smoking Gun, Pearl 2, by Agnew. I felt like Madame Defarge, that Charles Dickens character in A Tale of Two Cities, who knitted her way through the French Revolution, casting on the names of aristocrats she thought deserved the guillotine. As an impartial journalist, my sweaters and mufflers were created with vigilance rather than vengeance. I found the knitting calming in those turbulent times, and it focused the mind in a way that was useful. By the end of Watergate, I'd filled a bureau drawer with the results of all that concentration, accumulated warmth for my husband and son. A decade later, still on All Things Considered, I took up the needles again, always in big sizes, then as now, 11s, 10s, even 13s sometimes. I like knitting projects that go quickly. This time, I was trying to quit smoking and needed something to keep my hands busy. So, in the 1980s, the Reagans inspired the woolen work. He said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." I tore up three rows of bumpy cable stitches and began making unisize sweaters to be shared by the family. Our son had grown so much it was taking too much time to knit for him and his dad. And now, in this new century, Here I am again, counting rows of nits and pearls for the arrival of a brand new member of the family. What a time in which to be born, an historic moment in the life of our democracy, when a woman or an African American will be their party's nominee for president. And a baby, arriving in a few months, will never know a nation in which it was not possible for either a female or a black to rise so high. Perhaps she'll be a knitter too, this little girl child, and use those skills, the nits and pearls that turn a simple strand of wool into something comforting, even consoling at times, to mark the historic or personal landmarks in her life. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.